from a policy perspective, I think what we want is to ideally prevent violence against civilians. And if we can't prevent violence against civilians entirely, to potentially try to halt it once it's begun. And I think in order to do that, we need to understand not only the incentives that drive governments and rebel groups to use violence, but also the incentives that might encourage restraint.
This is Civios, your source for public affairs research. A podcast from the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota.
In this episode, we are talking with Jessica Stanton, an associate professor in the global policy area at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs. Her research focuses on international relations, including the causes, dynamics, and resolution of civil wars. She is the author of Violence and Restraint in Civil War, Civilian Targeting in the Shadow of International Law. Thanks for sharing your research with us today. Before we get into specifics of your research, Jessica, I'd like to hear more about what motivated you to begin studying civil war violence.
I became interested in this in the late 1990s when I was first studying international relations, and conflicts like Bosnia and Rwanda were in the news quite a bit at the time. Both of these conflicts involved extreme atrocities against civilians, and those atrocities were on vivid display in the news media at the time. And also around this time, I became interested in international law. So there were tribunals that the United Nations set up to try individuals for atrocities committed in Bosnia and in Rwanda. And also at this time, in 1998, states set up the International Criminal Court. They signed the Rome Statute, which was a treaty establishing the International Criminal Court. And the idea was to be able to hold individuals accountable for crimes like ethnic cleansing, genocide, and war crimes. So these tribunals and eventually the International Criminal Court were set up to prosecute individuals for violations of international law, and in particular for international violations of international humanitarian law. So watching all of this happen, though, I wanted to know whether international law had any impact during wartime. So certainly holding individuals accountable for atrocities is important, and these tribunals were making great progress in that regard. But the body of international law that they were applying, international humanitarian law, was initially set up to establish constraints on actors during wartime. It was supposed to try to get actors to constrain their behavior during wartime. And so I wanted to understand whether that was really possible, whether there was any chance for international law to constrain the behavior of actors during war.
Again, how did you study? How did you go about doing this research?
I did a couple of things. I did do some field research on conflicts in Uganda and Indonesia. So that meant going to Uganda and Indonesia and spending about a little over a month in each place trying to interview as many people as I could who had knowledge of the conflict. So I interviewed people on both sides, government officials, government leaders, members of the military, also former rebel group members in both cases, individuals who were involved in non-governmental organizations who had a lot of knowledge of the conflict, local officials, basically anyone who would talk to me about those conflicts. And I chose conflicts in Uganda and Indonesia because they represented cases at two different ends of the spectrum in terms of violence. So in Uganda, I was interested in the conflict involving the Lord's Resistance Army, the LRA, which is a rebel group that was fighting for many decades against the Ugandan government. Joseph Kony is well known for, in particular, the Kony 2012 campaign kind of brought him to prominence. But Joseph Kony and a number of other leaders of the Lord's Resistance Army were indicted by the International Criminal Court for crimes that they committed in northern Uganda. They engaged in extreme violence against civilians, massacring civilians at some points in the conflict, mutilating civilians, burning civilian homes and crops. And one of those rebel group leaders of the Lord's Resistance Army is actually currently on trial at the International Criminal Court. At the other end of the spectrum, the conflicts in Indonesia that I was studying were the conflicts in East Timor and the conflict in Aceh, which is a region at the kind of northernmost tip of Indonesia near Malaysia. And in both of those cases, rebel groups were seeking independence from the Indonesian government, from Indonesia. And rebel groups in both of those cases, they did engage in attacks against the military. They engaged in what we might call guerrilla warfare, kind of hit-and-run attacks against the Indonesian military and military targets, military units out on patrol. But they largely avoided violence against civilians. And so I was interested in that contrast, kind of how could we understand that contrast between these cases? Why, on the one hand, would you have a rebel group that would engage in very extreme levels of violence against civilians, as in the case of the LRA in Uganda, and then other rebel groups like Fretilin, which is the rebel group in East Timor, or the Free Aceh movement in Aceh, that largely avoided attacks on civilians?
So as you talk about these examples of conflicts that you've studied, I think it's important to step back and talk a little bit about what your definition of civil war is. What, generally speaking, is the definition of the civil war?
So a civil war is a violent conflict between a government and at least one non-state armed actor. I call those rebel groups. You might hear the word insurgent group, some people might say. So in a civil war, the non-state actor is fighting for some sort of political stakes. It could be that the group wants autonomy or independence from the government, as in the cases in Indonesia. Another recent example of that is in South Sudan, where the rebel group fought for many decades to gain independence and successfully did gain independence for South Sudan. In some cases, the rebel group might want to overthrow the central government or might want to change the nature of the government, make it more democratic, for example, or more representative. Syria would be a good example of that, where rebel groups have been fighting against Assad's dictatorship to change the nature of that government.
So in your book, you talk about the idea of restraint. So can you say more about that? What do you mean by restraint?
Sure. So restraint, for me, is about restraint towards civilian populations specifically. So all civil wars involve violence by definition. Governments and rebel groups attack one another's militaries. They attack one another's military bases, their supply lines. But civil wars vary quite a lot in terms of the character of violence towards civilians. And so by restraint, I'm referring to cases in which the government or the rebel group avoids attacks against civilian targets. So in these cases, the government or the rebel group makes efforts to differentiate between military targets and civilian targets, and specifically avoids attacks on civilian targets. And I call this restraint because in order to carry out strategy of restraint, it requires the government or the rebel group to do things like train its military forces to make that differentiation between military and civilian targets. It requires sometimes punishments for transgressions. It requires kind of building a culture within the organization to encourage this kind of behavior.
So why is it important to study restraint?
So I think restraint is important because kind of typically we focused primarily on violence and understanding why we see violence in civil wars and kind of understanding those patterns of violence. And I think we haven't paid enough attention to the fact that not all civil wars involve extreme violence against civilians. That's certainly kind of the picture we would get from media attention to civil wars. Media attention tends to focus on these most extreme conflicts. But in fact, I found when I was doing the research and looking across cases of civil wars, I found that, in fact, there were quite a lot of cases in which governments or rebel groups did not engage in severe violence against civilian populations. And I think it's important to understand those cases because there might be factors that are driving governments and rebel groups to avoid violence against civilians that might help us to understand how we might encourage that kind of behavior. You know, from a policy perspective, I think what we want is to ideally prevent violence against civilians. And if we can't prevent violence against civilians entirely, to potentially try to halt it once it's begun. And I think in order to do that, we need to understand not only the incentives that drive governments and rebel groups to use violence, but also the incentives that might encourage restraint.
So let's take this a little bit deeper. And if we're seeing that governments and rebel groups stand to gain from exercising restraint, why do we still see so many atrocities in civil wars?
it's certainly the case that governments and rebel groups often sometimes see benefits to engaging in violence against civilians. So that one of the arguments that I make is that both violence and restraint can be strategic, and that governments and rebel groups make strategic calculations about the use of violence against civilians. And often they do calculate that they see some strategic benefit to attacking civilians. So, for example, they might attack civilians because they believe that civilians are aiding the other side. And by attacking civilians, they can undermine that source of support for the opponent. They might also do so to try to increase the costs of the conflict for the opponent. If you attack the other side's supporters, civilian supporters, then you make the conflict more costly for the opponent. Maybe you encourage them to make some sort of concessions in order to halt those costs. So I think that certainly violence against civilians is strategic, and so that helps us to understand why we do see quite a lot of violence across cases of civil wars. But on the other hand, one of the arguments I make is that restraint, too, can be strategic, and that governments and rebel groups sometimes exercise restraint towards civilians because they believe that they will benefit from doing so. And so that, too, can be a deliberate choice during wartime.
So, Jessica, in your work, what can international actors do to halt or prevent violence against civilians? What do you think is possible?
From the perspective of international actors, I think that it is possible in some cases to halt or prevent violence against civilians. I do think it depends on the case. There, in cases where governments or rebel groups believe that they need international support in order to achieve their objectives in the conflict, I think it is possible for international actors to encourage restraint in those cases. So a government or a rebel group, for example, that thinks that it needs international diplomatic support in order to secure a favorable outcome to the conflict, a favorable negotiated settlement, those governments and those rebel groups might exercise restraint in order to appeal to international actors for diplomatic support. So, you know, from thinking about it from the perspective of international actors, what might they do? You know, they might be able to identify those cases in which governments and rebel groups really need international support in order to secure a favorable settlement to the conflict, and kind of create positive inducements in those cases. You know, I think we tend to focus from a policy perspective, we often focus on the punishments we might kind of impose for violence. So we think about things like arms embargoes or economic sanctions or, you know, in some cases even military intervention. But one of the arguments that I make is that, you know, in a lot of cases, governments and rebel groups that use violence, they've already calculated that they can withstand that kind of pressure in a lot of cases. So they've already calculated that they can withstand economic sanctions or diplomatic pressure.
And that's what we're seeing right now in the Syrian conflict.
Yes, I think so. So in Syria, you have a case where the Assad government has backing from powerful international actors, Iran and Russia. It also has quite a small group of supporters domestically within Syria whose support it needs to retain in order to maintain power. And so the Assad regime doesn't need support from kind of the Western international community. It's already calculated that with that strong backing, it can, from Russia and Iran, it can withstand diplomatic condemnation, economic sanctions, other kinds of pressures that might come. And so I think, you know, unfortunately, a case like that, there isn't much that international actors can do to induce restraint unless international actors are willing to intervene militarily, which clearly they're not in this case. But there are other cases that are more promising, cases where the government or the rebel group doesn't have a powerful international backer, like Russia or Iran, cases where the government or the rebel group thinks that it really needs support from Western international actors at the negotiating table, for example. And in those cases, those governments and those rebel groups might calculate that restraint is one way for that them to gain that diplomatic support.
So conversely, then, why do you sometimes see restraint being exercised?
Governments and rebel groups exercise restraint when they have broad domestic and international audiences whose support they need in order to stay in power or to obtain power in the case of rebel groups. So governments and rebel groups, they think about, you know, who are their supporters domestically and internationally, and they think about whose support they need in order to get what they want. And even though typically we might think of civil wars as ending through a military victory with one side winning and the other side losing, in practice, in the past, let's say, 30 or so years, most civil wars have ended through a negotiated settlement. About 70% of conflicts since the end of the Cold War have ended through a negotiated settlement. And most of those negotiated settlements are mediated by international actors, sometimes the United Nations, but sometimes foreign governments. And so governments and rebel groups, I argue, they know that. They know that they're probably going to have to sit down at the negotiating table, and they're probably going to have to use whatever leverage they can at the negotiating table to get the best possible settlement. And so governments and rebel groups that anticipate that they're going to need broad support domestically and internationally, especially support from Western international actors, they often use restraint deliberately and strategically in order to make those appeals for support. So it's one tool among many that they might have to make appeals to international actors to support them at the negotiating table and to offer diplomatic support. And they hope, they don't know for sure, but they hope that that might give them greater leverage to achieve a favorable settlement to the conflict. And so the governments and the rebel groups that are most likely to exercise restraint are the ones that are vulnerable in some sense. They really need that support from international actors and especially Western actors to get what they want in the conflict.
What are the policy implications of your research?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, thinking about kind of why governments and rebel groups exercise restraint, that can be informative for policymakers. If they know that governments and rebel groups are thinking ahead to negotiations and the prospect for negotiations to end a conflict, I think that actually gives policymakers a lot of tools that they might be able to use to encourage restraint. So I think one thing that we see is that if international actors can get the two sides to the negotiating table and can sustain those negotiations, even if that requires quite a long period of time, that during those negotiations, often that gives policymakers greater leverage to kind of keep the two sides in line and to encourage restraint during that period. We see this in the case of the LRA in Uganda. This is a rebel group that, you know, was described in the media as engaging in unfathomable violence, violence that had no explanation, no objective, nothing that we could kind of make sense of. But even in that case, I looked at incidents of violence over time, and I kind of compared that to the periods of negotiations between the Lord's Resistance Army and the Ugandan government. And what I found is that even this group that was engaging in what people thought was, you know, completely inexplicable violence, even this group was responding to government actions. And so at times when the government was negotiating with the Lord's Resistance Army, violence against civilians dropped. And as soon as the government backed away from negotiations, violence against civilians would spike. And so even in this case, this group, too, was using violence strategically. And they showed that they were willing to scale back violence during periods of negotiations. So I think that even though, you know, it might be distasteful in a lot of cases to negotiate with groups that we think are engaging in heinous atrocities against civilians, if international actors can invest in those negotiations and can try to keep those two sides at the negotiating table, that offers some kind of hope for encouraging restraint towards civilians. And then I think we also see that there are cases where there's even greater hope, cases like the Indonesia cases I studied, where there the rebel groups were facing this very powerful government in Indonesia. They really didn't think that they could get the government to make the kinds of concessions they wanted at the negotiating table. And so their only real hope was to get international actors to pressure the government to make those concessions. And so in these cases, the rebel groups turned to the international community. They lobbied the international community extensively. They sent diplomatic representatives abroad to try to win international support. And it was because they really viewed this as their main chance of kind of gaining leverage with the Indonesian government. And so in those cases, the rebel groups exercised restraint, again, in order to be able to try to make those international appeals. So I think, you know, from a policy perspective, if policymakers are kind of thinking about how they might induce restraint, I think we see from these examples that if policymakers can offer positive inducements to groups, and I think this applies to governments as well. I've given examples of rebel groups, but I think it applies to governments. If policymakers can offer positive inducements to groups to make it clear that there's something that they can stand to gain materially from exercising restraint, then we might be able to encourage restraint among actors in civil war.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Civios, an initiative of the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. To learn more about this segment, please visit civios.umn.edu.